decided I'd figure that out first instead of giving a terrible joke while I fixed the recorder like last time I was up here. We're in this really amazing series called Love Jupiter. I don't know how unique this feels, but to me, like a lifer, churchgoer, this is a very unique January series. My entire life, January's sermon series have been filled with like resolution type sermons about like, what am I gonna do to be a little bit better? Like for my own benefit, I've gotten a lot of that over the years in January, and it's so refreshing to have a series that is saying other people's lives are our focus and other people's needs are our focus. And that's just super refreshing to me, so I'm super thankful to get to help out. This culture really struggles with some of that. And I'm on the front lines with juniors and seniors in high school every day. I teach juniors and seniors in high school, and some of them have their own unique perspective, and some of them are just saying what they hear at home. And there's been I've got a lot of pushback, especially this week, about loving other people no matter who they are. And it's been a theme. It's been a theme for the year. Not from all the kids, but you know how it always works. The loudest kid is the one you hear and not the ones that are totally flowing with you. Well, we've been studying world religions in Senior Bible. And so we'll cover a religion, and then at the end of it, I'll say, okay, now how can we build bridges to be a light to these people, our neighbors? And it always starts out with the two same phrases. We're going to love them, and then we're going to befriend them. And they were kind of on track with me for Judaism, but we got to Islam this week, and they were not feeling that at the end. They were like, love was enough of like a worry for them, but befriending seemed like an impossibility. And when I asked for like, why are we feeling this way? They gave answers that sounded like they're fearful and confused still about that people group. And first of all, I was like, I just spent like 2 weeks like trying to clear this up. We shouldn't still feel this way. But it was that scary thing that really is just about with any other person of acting outward with what I might feel that is good inward. And so this is the definition I gave them for befriending. It's the outward movement of inward love. So you take that good intention of love that you have, and then you do something with it towards another person, because love can't be felt without you acting on what you feel. And that's a lesson from 20 years of marriage. I am the king of inward love. Never, ever once has inward love towards my wife ceased. In no moment, in no time, inward love overflowed. But I'm the king of the appropriate, timely, outward, not being always present. Maybe you're with me, guys. It allows your spouse to have moments of doubt that the inward love is there, because there's no expression of it. There's no evidence. Sometimes I could not win in a court of law that I love my wife because I could not prove it that day. That works with all of our relationships. Jesus asked us to love our neighbors as ourselves. In fact, he paired it with loving God as the greatest commandments. It's like, if someone asks you, so what's Jesus about? It'd be loving God and loving our neighbors. That's what he's about. That's his primary message. And so one time Jesus was asked by a lawyer, who qualifies as my neighbor? The asker was probably a lot like my students, who are hoping that there's a list of groups that can be left off. Who's my neighbor? Please don't let it be this group that I struggle with loving. Please don't let it be this group. And we could all fill in the blanks in our head on who those groups might be. It could be something as simple as a religious group that we talk about in my class. It could be something that is just people who hurt and are kind of messy and they're in front of us. Jesus does not give a list of exceptions. In fact, he gives a mind-blowing parable that makes sure that there is no doubt that every single person is your neighbor. So when he says love, he means to all. So here's how it goes. A man was going down, this is in Luke 10. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road. By chance. Woo! This guy is getting a break. The first part, he's not getting a break. That's bad. He's gotten attacked. He's down. But what a break to have a super religious zealot coming your way. Like, if there's anyone who is going to see you and care for you, it would be a man of God, right? That would be what you'd be like, yes, I can tell by your uniform that you're going to help me. And when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Like, I'm over here. Maybe I didn't see you, whatever. What happened? We can't say that he didn't love the guy. We don't know that. Maybe he did. Maybe he loved him theologically. You know, like, theologically, you're another person that I care about. And so God affirms my heart. But he didn't do anything. And so the love that he may have had in his heart towards the half-dead man on the road means nothing to that man. But he gets another break. Likewise, a Levite, when he came to that place, saw him. So, man, that was a weird thing that just happened with the first guy walking by. But now we have a descendant of Moses, a Levite. This is a tribe of people who have been the enforcers of the law of God. Woo! And the law of God says, love your neighbor. It's Old Testament too. So here comes the Levite. You're like, I'm going to get some help. He's not going to be like the priest who maybe just forgot about that. This is a Levite who has all these laws memorized. And what happens? It says he passed by on the other side. Same thing happened. This beat up guy on the road has the two most religious people on the planet walk past him. And his circumstance didn't change at all. He's walked around, he's considered not worth being considered. And you gotta wonder how many people in Jupiter feel that way about church folks. You hope it's not the case, but it is possible the case for the church reputation at large. But there's hope. Here comes the third person. A Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was. Now, it's super easy to assume that this man, the beat-up man on the road, is Jewish because of how Jesus is telling the story and who he's telling the story to. And so what it means is that the man who needs the help has a man approaching, a Samaritan, whom he wouldn't even talk to if they saw each other in the market. He's a man who he would have marginalized. So he's not feeling real good about this one. The first two, yeah, they should help me. This one is definitely not going to help me. I might not even want it. I might even want this guy's help. It depends on how much his pride's intact, right, in his beat-upness. But here comes the Samaritan. When he saw him, he had compassion, and he went to him, and he brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I'll repay you when I get back. So what happened here is the Samaritan considered the man on the road his neighbor, which, remember, this is the question Jesus is answering, who is my neighbor? Boom, this is the story. If the guy on the road, being Jewish, is the Samaritan's neighbor, and then vice versa, then Jesus has proved that everyone is everyone's neighbor by using that whole social divide. And not only did the Samaritan consider him his neighbor, which the priest and the Levite might have done in their heart, he acted on that love and he befriended him. And he cared for his need. And That's because love is, you've heard this before, love is the process of meeting needs. And this Samaritan met them all. He didn't like halfway befriend him. He was weird about how thorough he was with the befriending. He went way out of his way, and it cost him time and money and concern in order to do this. Jesus asked the man who asked the question, "Who's my neighbor?" Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell among robbers? So let's see the options. Was it the priest who passed him by, the Levite who passed him by, or the Samaritan who had compassion, served him, and met his needs, you know, had mercy on him, and the man rightly said, the one who showed him mercy? It was like a really easy multiple choice that all my students would love. Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." Now, are you ready for some Bible literacy 101? It's my second favorite thing to teach. Okay. There's a difference between law, what you should do, and gospel, what God has done for you. Okay? Two different languages God speaks in the whole Bible, law and gospel. And when Jesus is approached by people who are not ready to hear the gospel, who are so still full of themselves and self-justifying that they can't hear the gospel, Jesus will give them law. He will give them law so that they might be broken by this law, so that they might be ready for the gospel. Because someone has to come to the end of believing in themselves as the answer to their problems. And so Jesus will give a command. Same thing happened with the rich young ruler, if you know that story. Right? The rich young ruler basically told Jesus, "I'm perfect. I follow all the commandments." And Jesus was like, "Wow. Well, then here's an 11th. Go and sell all your possessions." That's not gospel. That's not even something that you need to like stress about or have anxiousness about. This is something that Jesus told somebody, so that's something I need to do. Because Jesus was using the law to break a man who's not ready for gospel. That's significant because Jesus knows that we can't follow laws. That's why he's here. So he's giving these doozies of a law to people who haven't been broken. If the guy had asked in his heart, right, Jesus knows people's hearts, if he had said, "Who's my neighbor?" and his reasoning was because he wanted to do something good for them, Jesus would have presented the gospel to him, which would have been, "Here's what I'm doing for you so that you might go do this for them." But instead, the man, it says in the text, was trying to justify his own prejudice. So Jesus gives him, "Go and do likewise," an impossible task, so that maybe you'll return to me and hear the good news. So if you're like, I thought this sermon was going towards go and do likewise, so now I'm totally confused. That's not where I'm going. Who best represents you in the story of the Good Samaritan? Spoilers, it's not the Good Samaritan. No, it's so self-centered to think that we're the main characters in Jesus' parables. It's almost never true. He's always the man. And that's super, super important Bible literacy. I'll drop that now. Okay. Who are we? Before Jesus has entered our lives and taken care of us, we are best represented by the man who got beaten and mugged. It's not very flattering. It's not who we want to be in the story. But we're the man in the street waiting to die in need of hope. And religion walks past us in waves and they can't help us at all because all they're offering us is uselessness. And then here comes Jesus, someone that we might have felt was another, kind of a weird guy. I don't know how we would have reacted to him if he just walked by. He scoops us up. He buys us our health. He takes care of us. He delegates a fully restored job to the inn. And so then, who represents the church in the story? Those who have been healed. It's the innkeeper. Now, that doesn't mean we get to stay in the inn. We have our own journeys and we get beat up again. And so the inn takes care of the inn, right? Jesus says to us, as we look at others, here are the broken in your area. I'm healing them. I'm in process. Will you take care of their needs while I'm away? And I will repay you when I come back. Does that sound familiar to like Revelation and the gospel? We are called to be the innkeeper. Unfortunately, there's a wrinkle in the story for us, in our reality. And the wrinkle is this. When we get the courage, the boldness to befriend and act outwardly towards someone, they don't always want our help. Sometimes it's because we have the reputation of the priest and the Levite. They don't want that guy's help. You've been passing me by for all these years. Sometimes it's something else more personal that's happened in our relationships, but they don't always want our help. They're bad patients. They're always pulling out their IVs and checking themselves out early. And we're like, I can't do my job. Well, giving a love to someone that can be received by them is more involved than just doing something nice. John Lynch says this, to the degree to which I trust you is the degree to which I will let you love me, no matter how much love you have for me. It's a missing ingredient. When we're ready to love outwardly, they have to want it in order to feel it. It's more than telling someone the time or how the weather's doing. It's an outward function of the heart, and we have to earn it. We have to earn the trust, which we just really don't want to do. We really just want to love people. But if the love is the process of meeting needs, it's a step that has to happen in order for needs to be met. Earned trust. Yeah, that probably sounds to you, if you've read The Cure, that the word earned, we associate that with the room of good intentions, and we're ready to punt all kinds of words like that far away from us. And we worry about our ability to do this anyway. We're like, how could I ever earn someone's love? I'm always letting people down. My ability is gonna fall short at some point. It's all going to start over. How could I ever earn someone's trust? Well, there's some good news about this that John wrote about on a blog about 2 years ago. So I'm going to share you his three points because I think they're really good news. He talks in like a first person, so we'll just leave it do that. You don't need me to be perfect in all my actions to trust me. You just have to be convinced I want to earn it. You just need to be convinced that I'll own my failures when I let you down. You really want to trust me because you really want to receive my love. And once you catch a hint that I want to love you well, you won't have me on trial looking for a reason to not trust me. You're giving me the benefit of the doubt with many free passes. And I'm also more able to trust you than I might give myself credit. Every day my inner person is being renewed and the new me is being revealed and I'm fused with the God of the universe. I am Christ in me. My past history is not an accurate indicator. This is huge. My past history is not an accurate indicator of my present capacity to love well. God is working endlessly to keep maturing me to be able to give the love I so want to impart. So we don't have to look and be like, I'm just a bad lover. I'm a bad carer. I'm a bad person. If Christ is in you and he's working in you, none of what has happened before, none of the passing people by, is an indicator of how much you can love and take care of people's needs today. We are the innkeepers of Jupiter, Florida. We've been recreated in Christ to want to earn our neighbor's trust, this entire city. And the deepest part of us wants to do that really well. And it's what Jesus is doing in us. So you might feel that. And we then get to enjoy doing it. Should be like a total reorientation. And this is huge. I want to give permission here, because this is the best way I learn. You can offer to meet needs in the areas that you can meet needs. You don't need to offer to meet needs in the areas that you cannot meet needs. That is not it's not go and do likewise, fully restore a person. It's I fully restore people. I paid most of it. He asked the inn, will you take care of this? Whatever you can, I'll pay you back. Whatever need you can meet. So you don't have to commit to meet needs that you couldn't possibly do. You can own up to failures when it doesn't work out. And you can stay with it. We can stick together with this, with one another. No quitting, because we know we're not perfect, and Jesus already was perfect for us. He's the Good Samaritan, and we get to just try. Maybe we could even try trusting each other with our needs. That's a big deal. Peter had dirty feet, which is the worst transition of all time. Seemed good when I wrote it. But Peter had dirty feet, like dirty, smelly, gross, worn out feet. All the disciples did. It was customary after a long day's journey to have a servant wash your feet. Okay. Transitioning to another story that will help push this to where we need to be. Jesus rose from supper. He laid aside his outer garments, and taking a towel, he tied it around his waist, and then he poured out water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel that was wrapped around him. So we have a need. The need is 24 stinky feet. Okay? Who can meet the need? All of them. Doesn't occur to any of them. They're passing by everybody's feet. And Jesus says, well, I can do this. I can do this. He comes to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? He doesn't think this is right. And he's correct. This isn't right. The King of Kings and the Lord of Lords is on his knees like a slave wearing a towel, washing dirt off of people's feet. Peter's like, I don't think so, Jesus. You're better than me. You're my master. Don't serve me. Jesus answered him, what I'm doing, you do not understand now, but afterwards you will understand. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. Which is another way of saying Peter doesn't listen to anything Jesus says. He's not trying to figure out the lesson. He's not even recognizing Jesus says there's a lesson here. He's just watching the feet thing and going, this is wrong. Jesus answered him, if I don't wash you, you have no share with me. Simon Peter said to him, Lord, not my feet only, also my hands and my head. So suddenly Peter's fine with Jesus washing him, but he wants extra service. He wants the full shampoo. He wants hand sanitizer. Like, I'm all in now, Jesus. Why? Because he's startled by the phrase, you have no part with me if I don't do this. So if you remember this, Peter is ignoring Jesus' attempt to explain to him this is symbolic. He's just not getting it. They never did. He's not listening that he'll understand it later. He's thinking too literally, like the basin of dirty foot water has an ability to attach him to Jesus in some way. But Jesus is using imagery. He's using imagery to show that we all need someone that shouldn't be the servant to be the servant. It's symbolic of what he's going to do later in that 24-hour period of time when he's arrested and he's beaten and he's crucified. It shouldn't happen, but it has to happen. The servant that shouldn't be has to serve, and we all need that washing. Peter's like, I'm not listening to your actual words, but this is all very exciting. Please give me a bath. Jesus said to him, the one who's bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but is completely clean. And you're clean, but not every one of you, which is a reference to Judas. So if I were to translate it, it would be, Peter, you know what? You're good. Your faith is, you're good. You're clean. Good listener? No. Clean? Yes, because of me. I'm moving on to the next guy. Peter knew this whole event was just off. It was just wrong. That Jesus was literally greater than everyone in that room, in that city, on the planet. And that was true. That was accurate. It wasn't Jesus' place to do that job. It was one of their places to do that job. The whole coming to earth as a human to die for our sins was an extended, disgusting foot washing event, symbolically, in Jesus' life when you compare where he was to what he did for us. Paul understands this better than Peter when he writes, "Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross." The foot washing wasn't about dirty feet. It was a symbol about Jesus' whole deal that he was within hours of fulfilling on the cross as an act of service. I pointed this out to my students this week. I said, look, Jesus is actually better than everyone else. Like, he actually is. Every single person, he's greater than being God. And yet he serves. We will never find a person worse than us. Your prejudices are wrong. Other people's messes are not worse than yours. Everyone is our equal, no matter who they are, no matter what they've done. We are equal to everyone else. People are people. Jesus served those who every single one of them were inferior to him. We then can definitely serve people who are equal to us. It's like the watered down easy version of what Jesus did. The training wheels. So loving Jupiter, I think every one of us do. That's why we live here and stay here, right? Is a good intention in our hearts. Befriending Jupiter, one by one, is an outward demonstration of that love. And that's the only way they'll really know. Love's the process of meeting needs. In order to meet needs, we have to earn trust as good innkeepers. There's no reason to walk by anybody because they can't be worse than us in any way. I feel like this was fast. I don't know. It might have been slow to you. We're going to transition into the Lord's table at this point. We have this opportunity every week to thank God for the cup of his suffering that grants us peace with God. And that was done by his broken body. So we have the bread and we have the cup that represents his full sacrifice for us. And we get to take that moment every Sunday to give thanks for Jesus to enter this dark space, this dark world full of pain, to experience pain, to walk where we walk, to smell what we smell, to see what we see, to restore us to where he is. And in time, we remember that he is like the Good Samaritan coming back to repay us. For every person, we extend his love in us too. And he said, just do this. He gave it a time stamp, like how long to do this. He says, do this until I return. Similar language to the Samaritan to the innkeeper. Do this until I return. He is returning. That's the hope we all carry to one another. So I'm going to pray, and then we're going to have music play, and we have an opportunity to take this in and consider his outward love and befriending of us. Dear Jesus, thank you so much. Words fall short. I say that all the time. There just isn't any language to say how thankful we are for what you did for us. The model you continue to be for us. We want to be good innkeepers, and sometimes we end up outside on the street again. Help us to turn to you and look for you on that road and not be clinging to other things passing by that can't help us out. Help us to look for your church to help, to be the innkeepers, to be the light, to befriend. Allow us to trust others to meet our needs. In your name I pray.